This is People in the Know, a weekday forum for in-depth coverage of the events shaping your country, your world, and the events that shape your life. Now, here's your host, Paul James.
It's the annual gathering of this country's top leaders and this country's top thinkers, and comes at a time when ingenuity and leadership is needed to weather the global financial storm. In the Chinese language, the two levels are commonly known as Ren Da and Zheng Xie, but are commonly together as Liang Hui. In English, we call them the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, or the NPC and CPPCC for short. The country's top legislature will open later today, highlighted by the annual work report from Premier Wen Jiabao, which is traditionally a broad outline of the social and economic plans for China in the coming year, and a review of the progress made the year before. So what is the expectation from Premier Wen's speech? And what recommendations over the coming days can we expect to hear from the NPC? Ni hao, you're listening to People in the Know, your window into the world around you. Online at crienglish.com, here on China Radio International. In this edition of the show, we'll be talking about the opening of Liang Hui. So let's get started. First, we'll try to get a broader explanation of what exactly the NPC and CPPCC is all about. For this, we're joined on the line first by Professor Jiang Jinsong with the Institute of Political Science at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences.
Mr. Jiang, thank you very much for being on the program. Let's first start out by, for our listeners' sake, those who may not be familiar with the way the political system here in China works, explaining what the National People's Congress does and really what it's sort of all about.
The National People's Congress of China is, according to the text of our constitution, the highest organ of state power. Or just in common words, it's the national legislature of China. But to use the national legislature, it might be a little misleading, because according to our constitution, this organ is not only preoccupied with legislation. In addition to legislation, it also exercises some other kinds of powers. Mm. For example, to elect national leaders like the state president, the premier, the head of the Premier People's Court, and the chairman of the Central Military Commission, and so on. And then this organ also maintains oversight of the work of the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress. So it should be responsible for a faithful implementation of our constitution. Mm. It's also a very important responsibility of this organ. Mm. So anyway, the NPC is not only a legislature, but usually we call it a legislature, so we should be careful about the common word. Mm. Sometimes it could be misleading.
Mm. Yeah. See what you're saying. So for our listeners' sake, explain how the NPC works comparative to the state council. Basically, per my understanding at least, the NPC sets policy and the state council, you know, enacts policy on a regular basis, correct?
Not really. As far as the policy is concerned, the standing committee of the NPC, it's really more the responsibility of the NPC standing committee to determine national policies, and instead of the National People's Congress itself. Mm. The National People's Congress itself usually meets once a session for a year, and for a duration of less than 10 days now. So it's just hear a government work report from the State Council. Mm-hmm. And in this state work report, we don't have every piece of policy as such. Mm. Instead, we just hear a review of the whole work of the State Council over the last year, and the program of the policies which are to be implemented for the coming year. Mm. But there is no specific policies under scrutiny.
Okay.
So if we talk about specific policies, we might, the budget, the national budget might be an example, but as you know, a national budget is not really a specific policy, rather it's a kind of expenditure plan for all policies of the national government.
Mm. Right. And also coinciding with the National People's Congress is the National Political Consultative Conference, the NPPCC, which acts as an advisory body for the government work. How do people, and what sort of work does the NPPCC do for the government?
Well, it collects policy advices from all communities of the nation, like from the industry, from commerce, from agriculture, from like sports. Anyway, every sector of the social life, they have their own representative sitting in that organ, and they connect opinions, advices to the State Council and even to the Communist Party of China.
Mm.
They may advise to the party and to the government, like to build a huge dam, the Three Gorge Dam,
mm-hmm.
like to provide more help to low-income populations, like to help the farmers and so on. Anyway, they may come up with many, many policy advices to the party leadership and to the national government. But this organ is not really any part of the MPC, and it itself is not an organ with any definite constitutional power.
Mm.
It's limited to advice. Its advice might be accepted because of its wisdom, not because of its power.
Mm.
So that's the basic distinction between the National People's Congress and the Political Consultative Conference.
Right. And to be a member of the NPPCC, do you have to be a member of the CPC? No.
It's not mandated. Mm. Some people, there are some exception. On the general, generally, people who are deputies to the MPC are not members to the National Political Consultative Conference, but there are some exceptions, like Mr. Jia Qingming, who is the chairman of the Political Consultative Conference. He's also a deputy to the MPC.
Mm.
These are just exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
As a rule, they are not encouraged or they are not to take both seats in the both organs.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Professor Jiang Jinsong at the Institute of Political Science with the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, talking about the opening of the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Congress as well. So let's get into some issues now, which the CPPCC and NPC are going to be dealing with. One is going to presume, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the economy is going to be a major talking point, do you think?
Well, I think so, because now the global economic situation and also the economic situation of China is quite worrisome. So our national government is quite responsible to the wishes of the people. They will take advantage of this opportunity to advance its policies to counter this economic depression.
Mm.
It's a good time for the State Council to put forth its anti-depression policies to the MPC for approval and to get opinions from the Political Consultative Conference for support.
Mm-hmm.
This will be done from the government work report read by the Premier Wen Jiabao to the MPC for Congress.
Right.
And yeah, so the deputies will be mostly concerned with how the government will go ahead with its anti-depression policies, which have been practiced for some time, I think.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to the political structure of the NPC and CPPCC, how does it compare with other forms of government, other levels of government around the world? I mean, has it been modeled after any sort of other design, like the United States, or is it uniquely Chinese, as it were?
Uniquely Chinese model. You know, when the Communist Party of China let the people, you know, writing a new constitution for the People's Republic of China, it deliberately reject Western constitutional models like the U.S. Constitution, the U.K. Constitution, which decided to follow the Soviet Union model. But even under the Soviet Union model, we have made some choices. For example, under the Soviet Union Constitution, the national legislature consists of two chambers. But here, here in China, we don't adopt a bicameralism. Instead, we have only one chamber, a one-chamber legislature. That's the MPC full Congress itself. And under the full Congress, there is a standing committee work on a bi-monthly basis for the MPC full Congress. But it's not a second chamber with that. The political consultative conference is never a second chamber of the highest organ of state power. And so in this way, China deliberately creates a unique constitutional model of its own characteristics for its own considerations.
The last thing I'll put to you is, when we talk about the government, how much separation are we talking about between the party and between government work itself? How much does the party separate itself from the work of the government on a day-in and day-out basis?
Well, this is a very tough question. It has been changed over time. You know, in the Deng Xiaoping era, Mr. Deng championed a separation of party functions from that of the government. But later on, this idea seems not to be in the mainstream of our political thinking. Now, instead, we see a new picture in which the party and the government actually intermixed with each other. On the whole, for example, the economic work should be the core part for the State Council. But when the State Council is to make an economic work strategy, it has to get approval from the top party leadership. And before the State Council makes a final decision, the top party leadership will deliberate over the economic strategy for the next year of the nation. And then the State Council simply follow instructions or follow decisions from the party leadership and make specific arrangement to have the party's strategy implemented. So in this way, both the party and the State Council are preoccupied with how the national economic well-being is going on and what the government should do to promote the economic development. Both are concerned, and both play an active part in this field.
I gotcha. We'll have to leave it there, Professor Jiangjin Song, with the Institute of Political Science at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. Thank you very much for the time, Professor.
Yeah, thank you.
And after a short break, we'll talk about the economic challenges the NPC and CPPCC will have to deal with. I'm Paul James, host of People in the Know. Join us every Monday to Friday for a window into the world around you. Online at www.crienglish.com, exclusively here on China Radio International. Hey, how you're listening to People in the Know, your window into the world around you. Online at crienglish.com here on China Radio International. I'm Paul James in Beijing. In this edition of the show, we're discussing the opening of the National People's Congress here in Beijing later today at the Great Hall of the People. For more on the substance of what we can expect to hear from the NPC and CPPCC, we're joined on the line now by Professor Sean Breslin with the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Warwick in the UK.
Professor Breslin, thank you very much for joining us here in the studio. It's a pleasure to have you in here. Well, National People's Congress and the Chinese Political Consultative Congress getting underway. Obviously, the big topic is going to be the economy here in China, with a projected growth of 8% this year. From your perspective, from the outside sort of looking in, what do you think? I mean, is the economy going to maintain the projected growth that China thinks it might?
I guess the real issue is how that 8% is achieved. Because I think if you look at the stimulation package, which apparently we're going to be able to see in full very soon on web pages, a lot of it seems to be in construction and pump priming parts of the economy that will work for a year or so. Everybody knows that there is already a problem with unemployment. Everybody knows that there is a stimulation package in place. I think the longer term problems are what happens in 2010 and 11. And whether in some respects what happens this year to hit that 8% growth actually jeopardises some of the longer term transitions from a, if you like, a growth oriented economy to a developmental oriented economy. So I actually see, yes, it's going to be tough, and it's going to be very tough for some people. But I think we perhaps should take a step back and think in terms of, you know, what happens after the 8% growth this year. In fact, what achieving 8% growth might mean for the developmental object in the longer term.
Yeah. Speaking of the stimulus package, we've seen it been doled out as far as the information about where it's going in short little microbursts, which areas are going to be hit or targeted.
Perhaps three things to say. I mean, the first is, I looked at this in some detail. Actually, a fair bit of this had already been promised before the announcement of the stimulation package. So I think some of it was already there, and the extent to which this is new is perhaps something that's still ongoing and being developed. So, I mean, yes, keeping it in confidence and keeping confidence in the government, particularly around the two conferences, is really important. Secondly, yeah, I just don't think they really know where some of it's going to go or where it's going to come from. And it's a matter of fighting fires in some cases. You know, let's see what happens. Let's see where's worst hit. Zhejiang at the moment, Guangdong perhaps, are the places to follow. So it's a matter of being in reactive mode rather than being too proactive. You can't just plan, I don't think, for this year. You've got to be in a firefighting mode. But thirdly, a lot of it is down to local governments. So I think we can think in terms of perhaps inconsistencies within the stimulus project itself, the need to be on a reactive firefighting mode.
We're speaking with Professor Sean Breslin with the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Warwick, here doing some visiting lectures in Beijing, joining us in studio to talk about the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Congress, and of course the issues that surround it, in particular economics. Part of the central government's plan to change the economies to try and make it more service-based. It's an interesting notion given the fact that this country has been so dependent on labor export for its GDP development. Is China ready to make that turn into a more service-oriented and maybe higher-value economy?
Is China ready? Are people in China ready? I think from about 2004, this current leadership decided that the economic model wasn't really working and wasn't really sustainable for the long term. And there had to be a move away from over-dependence on exports, a move towards more domestic consumption, and a move, as you say, towards service sectors. And there were a range of policies that were implemented to, if not deter, then not encourage the export growth process that we've seen in recent years. We saw the appreciation of the renminbi, which increased the price of Chinese exports in key markets. We saw the removal of tax rebates, for example. And these were taking place late 2007, early 2008, but almost immediately began to impinge on the very thin profit margins, very narrow profit margins of many exporters. And it's, you know, no coincidence that in the summer of 2008, all of China's top leaders went to the coastal provinces. And we began to see a reaction because the economic reform and opening in China has created important interests in the coastal areas that are bound to the fortunes of the global economy. So is China ready? There are important interests, important voices in important parts of the country that aren't ready.
Foreign direct investment here in China is, of course, an important aspect of China's economy as well. But with the downturn, one has to presume that that is going to start to slow down significantly because nobody else has any cash out there.
Sure.
How do you get past that hurdle? I mean, do you break down tax barriers? Do you set up other incentive programs for foreign enterprises to come in here and do business?
Sure. I mean, I think we'll see an even stronger reversal of the reduction of taxes, for example, and more incentives to try and get foreign investment into those places that are so dependent on export growth. But as you say, it's a double problem. It's a double problem because the supply of money is drying up and the demand for the produce is drying up as well. So even if we provide incentives for investors, if they can't then sell what they're producing on the key markets of North America and Europe, then there's not a lot can be done. And just look at Japan. I mean, Japan's exports dropped, 46%. This is something that is far from unique to China. So yes, I suspect that we will see an even stronger return to the incentive-driven model of attempting to gain investment to produce exports, but in an environment now where there isn't that great a supply of the money and there's not a great demand for the produce at the end of it. So very tough times ahead, I think, in terms of the investment-export nexus, which makes the question of the longer-term sustainability of the model of what's happening and what's being done this year to overcome the crisis perhaps even more urgent.
Yeah, buying up U.S. debt. Something, of course, which Hillary Clinton made a real point of saying, yeah, keep it coming, when she was here for her most recent visit. But do you start to question this now as the status of the U.S. economy sort of stumbles into this area?
Yeah, sure. I mean, holding dollars isn't the great asset that it once was. I mean, the value of those dollars has decreased quite substantially, and of course that they have been used to try and diversify a bit because you don't want to be stuck with a single currency. I think a couple of things will happen. I think slowly we will see slowly return into the American market, not to necessarily buy bonds, but actually to buy banks maybe, and parts of banks. And I think we'll see the ongoing movement of small, medium enterprises with the support of the government into Europe and elsewhere, again, buying productive capacity, buying into perhaps patents and know-how, rather than just holding these bonds.
Yeah. Speaking of which, though, if we're seeing actual material investment by the Chinese side, from a geopolitical standpoint, how much willingness is there going to be out there for countries in Europe and the United States or Canada or elsewhere to have Chinese firms and Chinese operations coming in and buying up their assets?
First of all, as we have financial crises, I think there is just a generic, almost knee-jerk reaction towards a more nationalistic stance. Mm. On the other side of the coin, though, that many institutions around with the money to come and bail out and buy things. I mean, people are looking at the Gulf, they're looking at Dubai, they're looking at Qatar, and they're looking at Singapore, Tamasek, and of course now they're looking at China. So I think some of the, should we call it ideological objections? Perhaps ideological is too strong. In places like the United States and perhaps Australia as well, have been replaced by necessity. And the necessity to find somebody to come, and the knight in silver armour with a few thousands or millions or billions of dollars might counteract some of those protectionist tendencies. I should say, in the United Kingdom, there doesn't seem to be any such fear of China. In this current environment, in this current economic situation, Britain and other European countries, I think the Spanish have said how welcome they are to Chinese investment, are really seeing this as not the threat that maybe it was 5 years ago, but as a great opportunity.
Yeah. Last thing I want to put to you is how to open up its books to the world from a public relations point of view.
It's trying to show itself to be much more open, much more responsive, much more willing to listen not just to what the people think of what it's done, but what it should be doing in the future. And much more consultation with academics, intellectuals, think tanks, normal people. On a domestic scale, I think the National People's Congress in particular, but also the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, they are becoming, yes, carefully constructed images of how the state is becoming more responsive and more open. So I think a change in the way in which the state thinks it needs to engage with the people, be more responsive to the people, be more listening to the people, and perhaps be more in touch with the people.
Professor Sean Breslin, Department of Politics and International Studies with the University of Warwick. Thanks a lot for the time. I really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you very much indeed.
And with that, we close out this edition of People in the Know, online at crienglish.com, here on China Radio International. Questions or comments for us can be sent to people@cri.com.cn or left on the Talk China forum on the CRI English site. For Executive Director Zhao Yang and producers Chen Mo and Xu Yang, I'm Paul James in Beijing. We'll talk to you tomorrow.